supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. The election of Donald Trump has spurred a wave of young, progressive Democrats to seek political office, and many first-time candidates will be targeting state legislative seats next year. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that change has already come to Philadelphia State House's delegation, and a youth movement of sorts is underway.
Historically, Philadelphia State House seats don't turn over a lot. They tend to be won by party faithful, often ward leaders who hold on to them for decades. But if you compare the city's State House members to those in office just 6 years ago, in 2011, there's been a striking change. Of the 26 people holding House seats then, more than half are gone. Some seats were cleared by scandal. Three newcomers beat party-backed incumbents to get into the legislature. One is Chris Rabb in Northwest Philadelphia, who says the presidential campaign energized progressive Democrats even last year.
I've never seen this level of excitement, of interest in hyperlocal politics, ward politics in particular. I haven't seen it in 15 years. And that fervor definitely helped me. There's a lot of people who saw me as a metaphor, as a beacon of hope.
Eight of the newcomers are younger than 40. One is Morgan Cephas, who at 33 now occupies the West Philadelphia seat held for two decades by Louise Williams Bishop. She resigned after it was revealed she'd accepted $1,500 from an undercover operative in a government sting operation. Cephas says there's an affinity among the new younger members of the delegation and a sense of common purpose.
We call ourselves the youngest caucus. It's pretty fun. We look at different issues that, you know, pretty much align with our goals when we look at our specific districts. And, you know, we try to, you know, come together and be a voting block.
That includes Martina White, one of only two Republicans in Philadelphia's delegation. At 29, she's the youngest State House member from the city and says despite partisan and ideological differences, she and the young Democrats try to support each other. Not all the newcomers are youngsters. One is 67-year-old ward leader Isabella Fitzgerald, who took the seat of Dwight Evans. He went to Congress after Shaka Fatah was convicted on corruption charges. The young progressives aren't reshaping the Commonwealth, since Republicans dominate both houses of the legislature. But the new Philadelphians say they can have a meaningful impact, at least in small ways. Jared Solomon, who unseated an incumbent 3 years ago, is establishing a program to clean the business corridor in his Northeast Philadelphia district.
So what does that do? Of course, you get the huge benefit of a cleaner business corridor. But most importantly, it sends a message to people. You know, wow, things are different. Skies are out there. They're cleaning up. I should get involved.
There's one disadvantage to being young in Harrisburg. Seniority matters in legislative bodies. Philadelphia used to have powerful leaders in the legislature, including Democratic Senator Vince Fumo and Republican State House Speaker John Purcell. Both went to jail in corruption scandals, and the city is far less well represented in leadership caucuses now. The chair of the city's House Democratic Caucus, Marie Donatucci, is a veteran of Harrisburg. She says, yes, seniority is useful, but she likes the young'uns.
I admire them. I love watching them. They have great ideas. They're not afraid to tell you their ideas, even if they're going to get shot down. But they have this umph about them.
Former State Democratic Party Chair T.J. Rooney says many of the new representatives bring impressive resumes, and he thinks they'll do great things as they gain experience. More change will come to the delegation next year. A crop of candidates is getting ready to challenge incumbents, and one veteran lawmaker, Republican John Taylor, has announced he won't seek re-election. Even many Democrats say that's a loss for the city, since Taylor worked with city officials on Philadelphia issues in Harrisburg and was a respected member of the majority party. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
Today, the Mexican consulate in Philadelphia remembered the victims of last week's devastating earthquake in southern Mexico. WHYY's Annette John Hall reports.
At the consulate, officials asked for a moment of silence for the nearly 100 people who were killed when an 8.2 magnitude earthquake struck southern Mexico. It was the strongest quake the country had seen in a century. Council Alicia Kerber says one of the agency's many duties is to keep the Mexican community updated and connected to the news coming out of Mexico.
Many of them could be concerned about what is going on in their states. So that's why we try to keep them informed through our media, through our network.
Consulate is offering to put people living in the Philadelphia region in touch with authorities in those states if they have concerns about loved ones who may be impacted by the earthquake. Fortunately, the consulate hasn't received any requests yet, but that doesn't mean people aren't worried about their native country.
We have received a lot of members of our community concerned about how can they help? How can they send help to Mexico?
The Mexican Red Cross has set up a special account for earthquake victims who need food, water, clothing, and other supplies. Kerber suggests people contact the consulate to find out how to give. Annette John Hall, WHYY News.
Every year, around 3,500 infants in the United States die while sleeping. That's according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. A tragic example in New Jersey came to the attention of NJ Advance Media, which embarked on an extensive investigation regarding that case and problems associated with co-sleeping in general. Joining me is lead reporter NJ Advance's Susan Livio. Susan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks for having me.
How did the case of JoJo Lemons come to your attention?
I received some emails from people who wanted to remain anonymous but were familiar with his death. And they were concerned that a call had come into the child abuse hotline alerting the child welfare agency that the mom in this case had just given birth, and she had revealed that a baby she had had a few years prior had died as a result of bed sharing, or while bed sharing. It was really a couch. In any event, so there was a concern that the state did not act on the hotline call, and there was the concern that it was a missed opportunity in their perspective.
Of her eight children, JoJo was the third to die this way. What did she say in the interview to you? What did she reveal?
She talked about how she can't believe this happened to her, took responsibility that, you know, these are her children. The first child that died in 2004, the medical examiner deemed that a SIDS, a sudden infant death syndrome case. And even though the baby was sharing a bed, there was no discussion about the dangers of bed sharing. And she took that as, oh, SIDS, you know, they don't know what happened. And so it really didn't hit home to her until it happened the second time when they were on a couch with their baby, Hakeem Jr. And that was a situation in which his, you know, a nephew who was a toddler during the night crawled up on a pillow under which the little baby was sleeping and accidentally smothered him. Again, the parents are responsible, but it was these freak circumstances. And then the third one was a bit more blatant, where, you know, many were sharing a bed after a night of alcohol and drugs.
What is the reaction, if any, from New Jersey's Division of Child Protection and Permanency? Do they object to any insinuations that they fell down in this regard?
They have declined to comment regarding my questions about JoJo Lemons, the handling of that case. They discussed how they've been proactive in educating, for instance, their child welfare staff. They are trained by the New Jersey SID Center. And just this January, the chairperson of the Child Fatality Review Board led an effort to help distribute what's known as baby boxes throughout the state. And New Jersey was the first state to do so. And so New Jersey is certainly aware of this. I think some lawmakers today feel like they could do more.
Susan Jojo Lemon's death and that of his two siblings is nothing but a tragedy. And as the complexities of this story reveal, there are no heroes or villains. Ultimately, at least in part, do improvements have to come on that larger debate around bed sharing? Some sort of consensus in that regard.
I think what we're hearing so far from reaction to the story is there needs to be a more proactive effort to make sure there's parent education out there. There's people in the assembly, the state assembly, who want to make sure that people know that these baby boxes are available and that there is assistance if people need it and can't afford it. I think there will be scrutiny on the hotline and on the system in which the state reveals information about child deaths. Questions are being raised today, and we'll follow them up and see where they go.
Susan, thanks so much for explaining and shedding light on this tragic case.
Thank you for having me.
NJ.com, Susan Livio. Today, Opera Philadelphia begins its new season with an experiment, a festival of operas, staging five productions in 2 weeks. WHYY's Peter Crimmins reports one of them will be a premiere of a new work loosely based on the 1985 bombing of the MOVE compound in West Philadelphia.
The writing of this opera, called We Shall Not Be Moved, started when Opera Philadelphia handed the writer Mark Bamuti Joseph a stack of 400 poems written by Philadelphia teenagers at the Arts Sanctuary in North Philadelphia. Joseph is the co-founder of the Brave New Voices National Performance Poetry Competition, and he found these poems to be underwhelming, not as good as they could be.
Working with teens from all over the country, I know that young people can be politically astute, can be cosmologically aspirational, can really be wide-ranging in terms of their political and social perspective, and I found these poems were just a little bit narrow.
That was 5 years ago. Joseph was thinking about how Philadelphia schools were in crisis. He was also thinking about the 30th anniversary of the MOVE bombing, when Philadelphia police dropped a bomb on the MOVE house in West Philadelphia. The libretto that would become We Shall Not Be Moved was not about the MOVE bombing per se, rather about contemporary teenagers living with institutions that were failing them.
These are young people who, in 2017, live in the crosshairs of race, politics, underfunded education, which I think in many ways are the same conditions that John Africa was responding to 40 years ago.
I want to fly free in a body that loves me.
The opera, premiering Saturday, is about a group of runaway teenagers who take refuge in a vacant building on the site of the MOVE bombing. It's populated by ghosts, reminders of the past. It's directed by Bill T. Jones, who vividly remembers the anger he and everyone he knew felt when they heard about the bombing and fire in 1985.
Those feelings, those hard feelings that we thought were put to rest, they're back with us again. The lesson of the MOVE event has not been digested.
Jones, an icon of modern dance, here is directing a cast that is mostly black, a mixture of classically trained singers, more popular singers, spoken word performers, and break dancers. It's a hybrid of many styles, and he says the work challenges the traditional opera form in order to attract non-traditional audiences.
I hear oftentimes from young people, young black people, well, I want to go see things where the people on stage look like me. What is in that statement? I want them to look like me. You also want the people on stage to feel like you? Are they doing a form that I feel represents me? Opera Philadelphia is putting right out there saying we're making a new form, and the audience will be welcomed, but they're going to have to learn.
While Jones seems uneasy calling this opera black music, the composer, Daniel Bernard Romain, is adamant about it. He jokes that he wants to sell T-shirts in the lobby that says, "This is black music." Some of the singers were chosen specifically because their voices sounded black. And Romaine wrote notations into the musical score to instruct his singers how they should deliver the notes.
In my score, you'll see things like as funky as a guitar solo by Prince. I write it right into the score. I've written into the score for Trayvon Martin. When certain characters first sing, mm-hmm. I actually have put into the score who I want them to think about as they make their entrance.
The opera grapples with police brutality, gentrification, a failing educational system. But Joseph, the librettist, says this is also a space for exaltation.
What I like to think about is this notion of black joy. Black Lives Matter doesn't come out of let's celebrate black life. It comes out of another black life has been unjustly executed, when in fact, black joy matters.
We Shall Not Be Moved will have 6 sold-out performances through September 24th at the Wilma Theater. Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
Amid the cacophonous clatter generated by construction, commerce, and congestion, a new photography installation around the Philadelphia Municipal Services Building offers an opportunity for quiet contemplation and reflection. Let's learn the ABCs of immigrant alphabet with photographer Wendy Ewald. And joining me in studio, Diana Misdary, Public Art Project Manager at Al Bustan Seeds of Culture. Wendy, Diana, welcome to NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave, for having us.
Wendy, what was the inspiration for you to team up with students from Northeast High School in Philadelphia to create Immigrant Alphabet?
It seemed the right time to be working with students who were immigrants and refugees. So I suggested we try to work on a project together, and that evolved into the Immigrant Alphabet.
Why specifically do you regard this as the right time?
It was actually right after the election, and there was a lot of confusion about the travel ban, and so it seemed important to figure out something that would address that and be playful and instructive at the same time.
And Wendy, there are 18 students as part of this collaborative, so with 26 letters of the alphabet, some had to double up, I presume.
Yeah, that was a little bit difficult figuring out who wanted what letter.
We note that there is no letter X representation.
Right. Well, that's one thing that we also were working with students from very many different backgrounds and very many different first languages. So we tried to think about how could we make that part of it, but also we wanted to make the alphabet understandable and to be an English alphabet, because this is the country that everybody had come to. So one of the letters which we used, obviously, was X, but in many of the languages that the students spoke, it wasn't part of the language. So we decided to make, instead of have xylophone or something that like that, to define X for these other countries by saying this doesn't exist in all languages. But also we decided that it would be good to have some kind of representation of each of the students' languages in the installation. So we included in each photograph the word in their own language. So it includes a little bit of all the students.
Diana, regarding immigrant alphabet, how do you intend pedestrians, motorists, whoever, to come upon it? And is it just to pass through, or is there an interactive aspect to it?
There's a couple of different ways folks can interact. So there's obviously the huge visual. These banners are 9 by 11 feet. You can see them driving down 15th Street or Broad Street. On the ground in front of each banner is a concrete decal, and the decals are really significant because along with the visual of the child's story, they also tell an anecdotal story. They give a window into the child's experience. And so you see words like culture, and you'll see the definition given by the student who created the poster, her definition of culture, and also a sentence that gives a sentiment or a story or a picture of, in words, of what culture could represent or how she imagines or manifests culture in her life. Another level of engagement across the entryway to the municipal services building, there are postcards that are free for all to take. Each letter has its postcard. On the back, you'll see the sentence and the definition constructed by the student. You'll also see a factoid, and the factoids are given as an opportunity for folks to learn and educate themselves about 26 immigrant-related issues. And the biggest interactive piece that we'll have will be these huge wooden boards that will be wheeled out onto the plaza each day. And on the boards, you'll see quotes, you'll see some of the banners represented facing the street. But on the opposite side, you'll see chalkboards where we're asking folks to talk about expressions of culture in their community, asking them to send messages of love and friendship and justice in their language, asking them to show us where they're from on a giant world map.
Wendy, not a surprise that America is the A word, but was it with you and these 18 students that the alphabet listings came up, including words like occupy, prisoner, refugee?
Yeah, that was really interesting, actually. I mean, we spent a couple of days going back and forth, and we had many, many words. We wanted it to both talk about, you know, the difficulties they'd had, but also they wanted to talk about the strength and the, you know, the happiness, like H is for happiness, that they'd experienced as well.
My only mild criticism for both of you is that you did omit the letter X, because I'm here to posit that, in my estimation, the exhibit is excellent. Thank you both for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Photographer Wendy Ewald and Diana Misdary, Public Art Project Manager at Al Bustan Seeds of Culture. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for Newsworks Tonight.